It is Thursday, March 15th. This is the Christian Commute. I am your host, Seth Dunn, and you are riding home with me at about 5:30. I hope your day went well. I hope you're enjoying your commute. This is a short week for the Christian Commute because I didn't commute Monday. And I think it worked out fortuitously because after today's question, I only have one more question in the inbox, which I can get to on Friday. And then after that, I'm going to be out of questions in the inbox. You listeners of the show who want something talked about, you need something answered, ride into the Christian Commute inbox. It's your theological roadside assistance. You can write in to SethDunn88@gmail.com. SethDunn88@gmail.com with show topic suggestions and questions about apologetics and theology. And today's show theme is a little bit, I mean, maybe a little bit. I don't know whether to call it apologetics or theology. I'll call it theology. It's called Stephen Hawking and Atheists in Hell. Stephen Hawking and Atheists in Hell. That is the name of the show topic. And I do have a question to answer. And I want to just make a note at the beginning of the show that I actually have three questions in the inbox, but only two are usable. I have one, and someone's asking my opinion about a blog and a blog writer. And I'm thankful that somebody wants my opinion on this. I think there's a good question there. But for the purposes of this show, I can't do it because nobody's read the blog. So that's from James. So James, maybe I'll read that and write you back. But keep that in mind, guys, when you're writing on stuff from the inbox. Like, don't write in and say, what do you think about N.T. Wright's book, New Testament People of God? Well, 1% of the people who listen to the show will have read that book, so they won't know what we're talking about, for example. Now, that's a popular theological, I don't know if you'd call that a history book or not. I've read a little bit of it, but if something's obscure and I'd have to say, here's what happened on this blog and re-explain it to you, not a good question. So remember that. But the two questions that I do have are good, and we'll get to one of them today. And today's Bible chapter review comes from Ephesians 6, verses 18 through 20. Ephesians 6, verses 18 through 20. All right, I'm already angry. First of all, when I was trying to pull on to the freeway on the side road, somebody turned into the little gas station I normally turned into, and they went so slow. Like, I almost had to stop to keep from hitting them. And now I'm at a complete stop on the freeway because, someone looks like they've broken down in the left lane. No, it's just a policeman. There is a police officer in the left lane, not moving. Oh, I see what it is now. There's a fire truck up ahead. All right. So he's way back from the accident, but one of the lanes is shut down up ahead. Is that car facing the wrong direction? I don't know what happened, but I had to make a hard stop on the Christian Commute. Car was swerving around, and already had to do that on the side road. So this commute, as Skip Carey, the late Skip Carey, would say, has an inauspicious start. And I wonder how in the world that person... It looks like a new car, too, because it didn't have a license plate yet. Ended up going the wrong direction on 75. Anyway, let me calm down. Let all that get out of my system, all that stress. Ephesians 6, verses 18 through 20. Ephesians 6, verses 18 through 20. Paul says, with all prayer and petition, pray at all times in the Spirit. And I think he's talking about in view of the defense we need against the schemes of Satan. Right? And he says, be on alert. And he tells us, or tells the Ephesians, I should say, to persevere and make petition for others. So here's the thing. Not only are we to stand firm ourselves and persevere in the faith and persevere in being gospel witnesses, persevere in being church members, persevere of being good family members, persevere in being good fathers, wives, and husbands, persevere in being good slaves and masters. Yes, we're to persevere in all that because the gospel, or I should say Christianity, affects your whole life. Everything, Sunday through Saturday, it is not just I go to church. It's how I live and how my relations affect everybody. How I work, how I do business, how I sleep, how I wake up, what I eat. Even though we don't have the old food laws, you get what I'm saying. It's everything about us. So we need to persevere living our lives, especially in this hostile world. Because when it's everything about you, you can't hide it. If you lived in a country where there was religious persecution and there was no religious freedom and Christianity was banned, all right? Biblical Christianity. Let's say you're under the Spanish Inquisition and the Roman Catholics are coming after you. So let's say you live in a country like that. You might be able to sneak off to your secret church location in a cave or, you know, in somebody's basement every Sunday and do corporate worship with the body of Christ and get away with it, even in a hostile atmosphere. But if you're sharing the Gospels with others openly, if people start to figure out you're different than them, like today somebody asked me, do you watch Game of Thrones? And he was going to make a point about there's some situation that we're in that's like a situation that happens on that show. And somebody's listening like, isn't that show about some fantasy world with dragons and stuff? And I said, no, I don't watch Game of Thrones. And I just said, no, I don't watch it. I wanted to say, no, I don't watch it. That's pornographic filth, and I'm a Christian, and I don't want to put that in my holy eyes. Listen, guys, I've got to make a pause. There's a car driving in front of me. It's white. It's not from Florida, but get this. It's from a hospice, Tapestry Hospice. You think somebody from a hospice would be in a bigger hurry because your clients and patients are about to die. Do you want to get to them on time? I want to get home on time, and my family, you know, they're all healthy. You know, we can go at any moment, but nobody has a terminal illness. Thank you a lot for making me not be able to get home in the fast lane, Tapestry, Hospice, and Healthcare. Go! All right. So anyway, back to what I was saying. I was almost went into full fundamentalist mode on that guy. Like, no, you need to repent of that. I ain't watching that pornography. But that's something different about me. That's a very popular show, and I don't watch it. Seth, you want to go have a beer and drink Game of Thrones? No, I'm a fundamentalist. I don't want to go watch your pornographic show with the violence and then drink the devil's alcohol. No, I don't want to do that. So even without being a fundy from Tennessee like I am, if you're living 7 days a week for the Lord, you can't hide that. And you're going to be persecuted if there's an atmosphere of persecution. And the God of this world is going to persecute you whether you're in America, where you're in America or China or ancient Rome. Now remember, Paul's in chains here. So Christians aren't necessarily safe in their Christianity in the Roman Empire like we are in the United States. We don't really get put in jail here. Now I'm behind another slow car. This is an aggravating commute. So we do need to persevere 7 days a week. Now it's interesting what Paul says here and the way he talks, because he's giving people consideration for themselves and considerations for others. He said, you need to persevere. That's something you do. And he goes, also, you need to petition on behalf of others. So you need to pray for other people to persevere. For all the saints, pray for all the saints to persevere. And then he says, I want you to pray for me. Pray on my behalf. Someone just cut me off and I had to hit the hard brakes again. This is infuriating. What is it about this Thursday that seeks to give me a heart attack? These people are ruining the show and my drive home. So Paul says, you should see me. I'm like clenched with my hands on the wheel. All these bad drivers in white cars. Somebody's gotten a good laugh out of this too. Stop. That's showing Freude or whatever they call it. Paul asked the Ephesians to intercede on his behalf. So Paul, in his position as an apostle, authoritatively tells the Ephesians how to live their lives. But look, even the mighty great apostle Paul, with all his authority, needs the prayers of the saints, because Paul is himself trying to persevere, and he is therefore asking the Ephesians to intercede on his behalf. When you pray on others' behalf of another, you're interceding for them. That is a selfless act. You're not praying for yourself, you're praying for someone else. And he wants two things, words and boldness. He wants God to give him utterance so that he can proclaim the gospel, the right words. And he also wants the boldness to say it, to preach the gospel, to proclaim it. It's not enough to just know John 3:16, all right? It's not just enough to know Romans 10:9 and give a gospel presentation to somebody, but you got to want to, even if the situation makes you uncomfortable. Even if you might get stopped by the police like I was on Friday night. That's boldness. And why does Paul need boldness? Well, he's in chains. He talks about boldness to proclaim the gospel for which he is an ambassador in chains. Right? Paul's Christianity, especially his position as an apostle in Christianity, has led to him being put in prison in this situation. So he's an ambassador of Christ in chains. And he even needs to witness to his captors. If you go read Acts, it talks about the cause of Christ being known among the Praetorian Guard. And why? Because Paul was a high-profile prisoner. So, as someone who's imprisoned, he needs boldness to speak out. He needs to persevere. All right? He's praying for the saints, help me persevere through your intercession. Because he has it rough. Right? And he's about to close the letter. And we may finish Ephesians tomorrow, make a clean break at the end of the week. I'm not sure. I think there's 3 or 4 verses left. But that's the end of the Bible chapter review. And now we're going to go right into a question about the Bible. This is in the inbox. Old Michael from Arizona. Michael's still looking for a job. Pray for him. And you can tell Michael's in a bad way because he's reading Job. All right. Sometimes when you're down on your luck or you're depressed, you read Job. And Michael's question, he says, what is the value of the bad advice given to Job by his friends? So if you'll recall the book of Job, it's wisdom literature, by the way. It tells the story of a man from Uz, or is it Uz? Who knows? And he's a prosperous man with a big family. And Satan comes to God, and he's like, Job's only such a righteous guy because he's so rich. And God says, fine. Go do a bunch of bad stuff to him. Do everything but kill him. And he's still going to be righteous, even though he's not materially blessed anymore. So that's why Job has, for lack of a better term, bad luck. So all this calamity befalls Job, and all his kids die. I think his wife leaves him. He gets boils. I mean, he's sick, destitute, loses everything, and his friends come to him, and they sit with him in silence to mourn with him. And finally, after the time his mourning has passed, his three friends start to speak up. And they all have a theory on why all this bad stuff has happened to Job. All right? And we find out at the end that all their theories are wrong. Now, of course, we already know their theories are wrong because the Satan and God are talking in the court of heaven at the beginning of the book. So the narrator and us, we know something that the characters, if you will, in the story don't know. That the devil is doing him harm and God is allowing it. All right? But Job and his friends don't know that. And people think, well, Job must be a good person. It's the old question people have, why do bad things happen to good people? And his friends are trying to answer this with worldly wisdom. And the point of this literature, when we're listening to the advice of his friends, is we're supposed to, in worldly wisdom, identify with their answers. These are the typical answers, Michael, of the peanut gallery of your friends. Well, this Michael's having a bad time because of this. Michael's having a bad time because of that. Everybody wants to explain something. One of his friends is like, maybe Job sinned, and that's why all this bad stuff is happening to him. And in the end, here's the thing. God doesn't even give Job an answer. He doesn't come down and say, well, you know, Satan and I were discussing it, and I was putting Satan in his place. He says, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? He basically says, you don't even really have the right to ask the question or try to come up with the answers. You can't fathom my reasons. And in the apologetics world, we call this theodicy. A theodicy is a defense of theism or a defense of a certain way that things are. So we look at how things are and we say, they're bad. Wait a second. God could fix them. Why are they this way? He's omnipotent. So we make a theodicy, which is a defense of God. And one theodicy is, God's omniscient, you're not. How do you know God doesn't have a good reason for how things are? That is a theodicy against what's called the problem from evil. And it even works against the problem from gratuitous evil. Because how can you call evil gratuitous? You're not omniscient. So that's basically what Job is. It's an explanation of why there's evil in the world and how we're supposed to react to it. We're just supposed to trust in God. Who is our example in the book? It's not Job's three friends. It's Job, who in all these things doesn't sin against God. And then God basically doesn't give him the answer. So the example we're supposed to take, Michael, from all the bad advice of the friends is exactly that. That's what not to do. Because at the end, God comes and contrasts their bad advice. And there's even a fourth younger friend who comes and gives a bad reason and bad advice. And God chastises them all and says, all you guys are wrong. So that's the lesson to learn, Michael, in Job. The wisdom is that we need to just depend on God. Like Job says, praise be the name of the Lord. The Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. And you never try and besmirch the character of God or unnecessarily blame yourself. Because sometimes people, they think, I'm having bad luck in life. I must have done something. God must be punishing me for something I've done. But if they got the wisdom out of Job, they'd know that's not the case. Because that's one of the terrible answers. When you've done something, you know you've done it. Because the Bible says God chastises those He loves. Like, no, you never get a spanking from your dad and you're like, well, what did I get that for? I don't know. When you get caught, you know you're caught and you know what you did. So it's never like, I must have sinned and I don't know about it. No, if you sinned and you knew about it and you were getting chastised for that, you'd recognize what it is. It's not that, well, maybe I did something. All right, so that's wisdom to get out of it. So Michael, you take the bad advice or the bad solution from Job's three friends and you apply that in your own life because that's typical of people. It's so funny. This is ancient literature. But people are still like this today because that's just human nature. It crosses time and culture. All right? And lesson learned, depend on God no matter what. All right, so now, Michael, thank you for that question. Now let's get to today's show topic, Stephen Hawking and Atheists in Hell. Stephen Hawking and Atheists in Hell. And throwing Stephen Hawking in here is almost kind of a clickbait. I could do this subject without Stephen Hawking. But his death kind of caused this question to come up in my mind. Jordan wrote an article at Pulpit and Pen, said Stephen Hawking suddenly converts to theism. And the idea is Stephen Hawking's died, and now he's in Hades awaiting judgment, and he's come face to face with the afterlife he didn't believe in. Now, Stephen Hawking, for those of you who've been, you know, missing from planet Earth for the last 50 years, he was, before he died, one of the world's most respected cosmologists. He's a physicist. And he's the guy in the wheelchair, because I think he had Lou Gehrig's disease, but he still, you know, managed to, like, do all his cosmology math in his head, and he was a research professor at Cambridge. I've read some of his books. I'm trying to think of the name of them. Was it A History of the Universe or An Explanation of Everything? One of the things that Stephen Hawking thought was important was something called M theory, which is coming up with a theory of everything that explains existence, all right? That you don't need God for, by the way. Because you Christians don't need M theory. God created everything and then he gave us the Bible, all right? We're not looking for a theory of everything. A Brief History of Time, yes. I think I've read A Brief History of Time and A Briefer History of Time. And, I can't remember the other book. But through his writings, Stephen Hawking revealed that he was agnostic or that he was atheist. And for whatever reason, people care about the theistic opinions of celebrity scientists. Another one that comes to mind is Neil deGrasse Tyson. All right, he's that black dude who always wears a tie with a moon on it. And he did the reboot of the Cosmos show. Carl Sagan comes to mind. Carl Sagan, you know, talked about the universe. He was like a pantheist. So Stephen Hawking, if you look at his ideas for the beginning of the universe, his latest thing was called the no boundary theory of the universe, which basically says we don't need God, just even though the universe has a beginning because there's no boundary. It's hard to explain the no boundary theory because, quite frankly, it sounds like a bunch of nonsense to me. And that's just not because I'm a scientific layman. So you think about the traditional cosmological theory, or at least the most popular one for the past half a century is the Big Bang, which posits that the universe had a beginning, an absolute beginning of space and time. And then some philosophers sat around and say, hey, wait a minute. If there's an absolute beginning of space and time, there has to be some kind of agent outside of space and time to begin the universe. Wouldn't that be God? Now, all these scientists, these arrogant, God-hating scientists, not all scientists are like that, but atheists are. Now, all these atheistic, God-hating, arrogant scientists who do nothing but spend their time thinking of things like Darwinian evolution and the no-boundary theory to try and prove that we don't need God, that we can explain everything, they hate that. Because it's like, oh snap. The universe had a beginning, and that means there has to be God. Well, people like Stephen Hawking come up with, well, there's a no-boundary theory of the universe. There's no beginning point because there's no boundary. It's hard to explain, but you can read his book on that. I forget the name of it. They had it at the Cartersville Library, and I read it. Because a lot of these science types say, well, you know, people have a God of the gaps. People don't understand how life in the universe has evolved, or they don't understand where it came from, so they make up a God of the gaps, and God fills up the gaps of their knowledge, and as science fills in the gaps, we need God less, and then we won't need God to explain things at all. But God is not a mechanism to explain things. He's a person. He's the creator. But some parts of society, or some sections of society, think, well, God is just a concept people made up to come up with things they couldn't explain. When the truth is, God created people and revealed himself to him. Nobody came up with God. God came up with you. So if you're an atheist listening, you didn't come up with God, or humans, I should say it like this, humans didn't come up with God. God came up with humans. Right? He's not a deus ex machina. He's not a literal deus ex machina. And a deus ex machina is a dramatic device. It's called God from the machine. Whenever you have a movie or a TV show and you're nearing the end and you need to wrap it up, or a play, you have something that explains it. Oh, it was this all along. And this word comes from Greek drama, because they'd have a play and then the characters would need to wrap up their conundrum, and a god would come, like Apollo or Zeus would come in and explain to the people, to the characters, well, this is why this is happening. And they'd have a prop on the stage. You know, maybe Zeus is riding in on a cloud. It was a god from the machine. The machine was the prop on stage. So deus ex machina in Latin is still a dramatic device that screenplay writers and television writers and novel writers use today. Well, now the book's getting too long, or the show's getting too long. Oh, it was all a dream. That's one. How am I going to explain all this? Oh, let's just make it a dream. Or how am I going to explain all this? Oh, the main character is an alien. That's what it is. It's just something that it doesn't require any plot development. So atheistic scientists, a lot of times, they view God as a deus ex machina, God from the machine, who's there to explain what we don't know. And that's why people make up religions. And Stephen Hawking was one of these types who believed that, I know so much about the universe. No, it's not God. There's no God. There's no judgment. You know, when I die, I'm just going to cease to exist. That's how it is. And he had all his theories about black holes and gravity and space and the no boundary. And some of them are right and some of them are wrong. All right. And then people look at these super smart science guys and they think, man, if they don't believe in God, maybe I shouldn't. Like, their opinion is just as relevant, as William Lane Craig says, as like a pro golfer. You're not a philosopher of religion. You're not a theologian. You know, a lot of these scientists have really bad philosophy of religion. So they see something about the natural world and they said, therefore, God doesn't exist. Well, that's stupid, because God's supernatural. How is a physicist going to opine on metaphysics? All right. So a lot of them have very bad philosophy. And that was kind of a problem with Hawking's thinking. Terrible philosophy on top of his science that led him to his atheism. Now, we all know what really leads people to atheism is their wicked heart and being turned over in their own sin. Look at Romans 1. And remember what Romans 1 says, that the things about God are apparent and then people deny them in their sin. So remember, there's really no such thing as an atheist. There's just the fool says in his heart there is no God. But the invisible qualities are known from what has been made, so that all are without excuse. So there's no such thing really as an atheist. Biblically speaking, there's no such thing as an atheist. We just have people who say they don't believe in God. And a lot of times people say, well, I don't believe in God because I don't have any physical evidence of it. If I had some kind of experience of God, if God wrote his name in the sky, if, you know, I met Jesus and saw him resurrected, you know, I would believe in God. So that's why we have people who'll say something like, well, Stephen Hawking believes in God now because he's died and now he's had to meet his maker. And stepping back for a moment, and granted, I didn't know the man personally, you have to think, well, if Stephen Hawking doesn't believe in God because he's discovered so much stuff about science, or does Stephen Hawking not believe in God because he's angry that he has a debilitating disease, he can't wipe his own butt? Quite frankly, if you can't wipe your own butt, I don't need you to tell me about God's failures. He's omnipotent. All right. But is he an atheist because he's mad at God for his bad luck? Or is he an atheist because he's stood on the shoulders of giants and seen the cosmological M theory? Blah, blah, blah. All right. Whatever reason he gave for being an atheist, people say, well, he's not an atheist now because there's no atheist in hell. That's the phrase. There are no atheists in hell. Because what happens is somebody's an atheist. They reject Jesus their whole life. They don't want anything to do with God. They die. Their body is resurrected. They stand before the great white throne judgment. And then they're cast into the lake of fire. And there's no atheists in hell because then they've seen God and they've seen God's judgments. I would like to submit to you that there are atheists in hell. Or there will be when people start going to hell. Now, I just got through saying there's no such thing as an atheist. Truly, there's not. Because there's just not. Everybody knows God exists. They deny it in themselves. So we define an atheist as someone who tells themselves and others the lie, God does not exist. And the reason people give, and I don't know if this is even applicable, except for interesting conversation if you're trying to witness to atheists. The reason people say there's no atheists in hell is because, well, now they've seen God. Now they've had their physical evidence for it. They've met Him. I want you to think about that. The theory that there are no atheists in hell is based upon the premise that the former atheist has seen God, they've been judged by God, and now they're in the hell they spent their life denying existed. All right? So in other words, they've got the evidence they've always said was lacking. Bertrand Russell was famous for saying this. Now, he was a famous intellectual atheist. I think he was a mathematician by trade. And they said, you know, Bertrand, if you die and then you end up standing before God in judgment and He asks you, why didn't you believe, Bertrand, what are you going to say? And he says, well, I'll just say, not enough evidence. Not enough evidence. So that's why people say, aha, you've died, now you've faced God's judgment, you've gone to hell, there's your atheist, you believe in God now, don't you wish you would have believed in Him before? I want to tell you something. That's a faulty premise. Because what does the Bible say? In Romans 1, look it up. The invisible qualities of God are apparent from what has been made so that no one is without excuse. In other words, there's already evidence for God right before us. Creation itself is evidence for God. And people deny that evidence and try to explain it through cosmology or naturalism or something else. What makes you think they don't do that in hell? What makes you think that perverted soul is not in torment in hell saying, oh, there's a naturalistic explanation for this. I'm having a bad dream. See, my whole life, what happened was people told me about hell and it subconsciously made me afraid of it. And now, you know, now that I've gotten close to death, I'm in a coma or something and I'm having this psychosomatic episode. It feels real, but it's not real. Or I'm in hell, burning in hell, but no, there's no God that would do this. I must be in some other prior state of existence. Maybe I'm in Catholic purgatory, working it off. Who knows when it'll be worked off. And maybe there's a wicked God who's done this to me, like the God of Gnosticism, who's like a demigod, or the God of Marcionism, who's some kind of demigod, and he's got people in his hell, but there's still a bigger God above him that's going to get people out. Right? There's explanations that the atheist can come up with to deny the truth, whether he's here or whether he's in hell. And here's an argument. This is actually something you can use for apologetic theodicy, in defense of hell, if you will, to witness to people who say, well, the God of the Bible can't exist because the Bible talks about hell. The loving God wouldn't send anybody to hell. Hell's not fair. What they say is hell's not fair because you're sent to infinite punishment for a finite sin. All right, I stole a bag of Skittles for Target. Now I go to hell. I mean, I would get 30 days of community service for stealing a bag of Skittles for Target, but from the government before God, I go to hell forever? These are all finite offenses. So that's what they reason. Now, my personal response to that is the offense of your sin is against an infinite being. So your unforgiven sin is of infinite punishment because as long as God exists, you've offended Him. That's why you're in hell forever. But here's another way to look at it. You go to hell for your offenses. And every second you're in hell, you're committing another sin, which is resenting God for giving you the justice you deserve. It's like people go to hell, this is just a theory, people go to hell, and then every second they're mad at God for sending them to hell, instead of being repentant and say, oh, I shouldn't have done it. And they're in hell forever because they sin constantly. So imagine that atheist in hell. There's an atheist in hell who still won't repent, and every second he's saying, no, there's no God. No, there's no God. No, there's no God. No, there's no God. He's coming up with something. He's so dead in his sin. I want you to think of how absolutely depraved and wicked the people in hell are. They sin every second. Now, the Bible does say this, which is one thing that wrecks my theory, is every knee shall bow on the earth and under the earth and above the earth, every knee shall bow and confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. So even the people, that includes the people in hell. And I would say that's the people in Sheol and Hades right now, that they have to confess that because they're before the great white throne judgment. And then they're judged based on their wickedness because they're not clothed in Christ's righteousness. But just because these atheists, going back to my original theory, just because these atheists are in hell and they've seen God face to face to be judged, doesn't mean they're going to deny He exists like they deny He exists in hell. Because what you're saying, there's no atheists in hell because they've seen the evidence. They've already seen the evidence and they've denied it. And in their wickedness, they'll deny even the strongest evidence. No evidence stronger than creation, is there? Thanks for listening to the Christian Commune. Lord willing, I'll be back with you again tomorrow for another episode. Keep your questions coming in to SethDunn88@gmail.com. And as always, God bless.